Good morning. I'm Alexis Strauss Hacker, Chair of the San Francisco Bay Water Board, and I welcome you to today's board meeting of the California Regional Water Quality Control Board for the San Francisco Bay Region. We'll call the roll for our board members in just a minute, but first, some logistics. Our meetings are hybrid, so in addition to in-person participants here in the conference room, we may also receive public comment through our Zoom meeting platform. If you're not physically present and intend to comment or think you might be interested in commenting, you need to be in the Zoom meeting space and not watching through our webcast. If you haven't already received a link for the Zoom meeting, you can visit our website and register through the link on the agenda for today's meeting. After you register, you'll receive a Zoom login link providing access to our meeting. If you're in person and wish to speak, you may also register online or with the assistance from our team at the registration table outside, so we know to call on you. For those in the Zoom meeting, you'll be muted until it's your turn to speak. Our staff will then promote you, and you'll unmute yourself on your computer or your phone so that we can hear you. When you're done speaking and board members have completed asking any questions they may have, you'll be placed back on mute. For those in the room here waiting to speak, you'll be called by name when it's your turn. Please make your way up here to the podium so we can best see and hear you. All speakers have 3 minutes for commentary. We ask you state your name and your affiliate organization, if applicable, when called upon. Thank you for joining us today. We look forward to a good meeting. And I'd now like our board clerk, Julie Haas, to call the roll.
Good morning. Board member Ransom.
Here.
Board member Beelan.
Here.
Board member Batty.
Here.
Board member Gunther.
Here.
Board member Kissinger.
Bill, you may be on mute.
He's mute.
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Beautiful. Yes. Vice Chair Young.
Thank you. Sorry.
No worry. Vice Chair Young is not here today, and Chair Hacker.
Present. Thanks, everyone. We have a quorum physically present for today's meeting, and we welcome you. Item two is the public forum. I'd like to open our meeting to the public and remind everyone that the public forum is for items not on the agenda today. You can speak on those items at the appropriate time and items that are not a pending or an impending matter, which means they're not about to come up on our agenda in the next few months. Please consult our board clerk, Julie Haas, who is seated here in the front, if you have questions. I'll call on our public speakers who have registered to speak under the public forum portion of the meeting. If you're remote and haven't been called, please raise your virtual hand on the Zoom platform by clicking on the reactions icon and then on the raise hand icon. That way we know to call on you. Again, each speaker has 3 minutes, will be timed and notified via the online timer visible on the screen. And we thank you for your understanding and welcome your participation. I'd like to call on our first registered speaker, Mr. Ellsworth. Would you promote Mr. Ellsworth? Good morning, Mr. Ellsworth. When you're ready, please go ahead.
Good morning. Thank you. Is my audio coming through?
Yes.
Very good. Thank you. Good morning, Chair Strauss Hacker, San Francisco Regional Water Board and staff. Jeff Ellsworth here, former mayor of St. Helena, Napa County, 2018 to 2022. I recently commented at the state level water board commending the commitment to racial equity in the water board racial equity action plan presented there on March 4th, a plan that combined with current state and federal laws, as well as resolution 2021-0050 can be implemented towards correcting systemic and institutional racism that hinders the full realization of civil rights for all. In this, I continue to highlight what appears a disconnect between this plan, resolution, and relevant laws with very real concerns related to the wastewater contamination impacts and other impacts to Latino waste workers at Clover Flat Landfill Upper Valley Disposal Service in Napa County that I've inventoried here these last months. You may ask why the Water Board is so critical in all this and why I keep speaking here. It's because the Water Board is the primary boots-on-the-ground oversight agency that can actually recognize environmental and civil rights concerns in real time. And many public agencies, including Cal EPA, Cal Fish and Wildlife, and the County of Napa, defer to field reports from the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Board. While those other agencies may not regularly be going to the UVDS sites, the Regional Water Board inspectors are, and their reports are often the first and last word whether problems are considered. if there was a mistake, it goes all the way up the chain. And mistakes have been made, unfortunately, particularly related to Latino worker impacts, fires, and wastewater containment. Recent findings by the Regional Water Board in these matters, unfortunately, did not include all relevant documentation, did not include necessary sworn testimony, and did not interview key witnesses. In recognizing communities of color, as the Water Board Racial Equity Plan does, how does this not extend to the primarily Latino workforce of Upper Valley Disposal Service that falls under direct oversight of the Regional Water Board, who physically observe these human workers every time their inspectors are on site? What we are talking about are well-cataloged, systemic, illegal hiring practices by UVDS and Clover Flat Landfill of undocumented workers over decades who are then abused into subhuman working conditions, including servitude or peonage-type conditions occurring with a company operating under exclusive government contracts. It is a reprehensible betrayal of public trust and civil rights protections, the details of which can be found in the current federal-level lawsuit against UVDS by its workers. In these efforts, we continue to work with LULAC, the League of United Latin American Citizens, whose 2024 resolution on UVDS worker impacts carries over to 2025. I'll include that when I send the these comments in. And finally, the commitment to racial equity and protection of civil rights is up to all of us and each of us on a day-to-day basis. Again, I ask for this matter to be agendized in hearings with sworn testimony, which I'm available to participate in. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ellsworth. Well-timed. Our executive officer would like to comment next.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Ellsworth, for your comments this morning. The civil rights and worker safety concerns that you have raised are not subject to the Water Board's regulatory or enforcement authority. It is my understanding that there are other regulatory agencies that have received these complaints and are taking them seriously. Regional Board staff will cooperate and assist with those agencies' investigations as appropriate. In addition, Regional Board staff will continue to inspect, monitor water quality, and regulate these facilities in accordance with the Regional Board's strategic work plan. And as you know, we conducted a comprehensive investigation that was concluded late last year, and we expended significant resources over a two-year period performing numerous inspections. We documented our reviews and interviews with current and former employees at both the UVDS and Clover Flat Landfill. The investigation report that was issued in December of last year concluded that further investigation or pursuit of additional actions against either facility regarding the water quality complaints is unwarranted. Our authority and our mission is to preserve, enhance, and protect the Bay Area's water resources. The Regional Board has no reason to compel parties to attend a public hearing or provide sworn testimony, as you suggest. And as I said, we will continue to cooperate with any agency who has authority over the concerns that you have raised regarding worker safety concerns. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ellsworth. I'll turn to our board clerk. Do we have others registered to speak?
No other registrations.
And none in the room. Very well. Thank you all. The public forum is now closed. Let's turn to item 3 and the minutes of our March 12th meeting. Are there any edits or revisions to the March minutes? And if none, may we have a motion and a second?
I'll make a motion.
Second.
Moved by Board Member Batty and seconded by Board Member Beelin. Julie, would you call the roll, please?
Board Member Ransom.
Aye.
Board Member Beelin.
Aye.
Board Member Batty.
Aye.
Board Member Gunther.
Abstain.
And Board Member Kissinger.
Aye.
And Chair Hacker.
Aye.
Thank you. The March 12, 2025 board meeting minutes have been adopted by the board. Let's move to item 4, where we have board member and executive officer reports. Let's start with board members. Oh, I should start with our liaison from the State Water Board, Sean McGuire, for some brief updates. Sean, would you like to go ahead?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Good morning, Chair Strauss-Hacker and board members. Good to see you virtually as always. I just want to provide a quick update to you today. And I think just reflecting on the time that we're in, and I can't believe it's April already in 2025. And certainly, I think one thing we can agree to is that there's a lot of uncertainty when it comes to the federal level at this moment in terms of water policy and actions that the federal government may be taking or may not be taking in that space. So what I wanted to emphasize and lift up is that, of course, we're not taking that approach at the State Water Board, and I know your region and the other regions as well, in terms of advancing critical water policy actions to protect water quality, to ensure safe drinking water, to improve and provide for water resilience for the future in light of climate change and a whole host of other critical issues. And it's hard for me to sort of encapsulate that and summarize that in terms of what we're doing at the Water Board, but we do have a strategic work plan that's updated annually. I'm sure I've mentioned it to you before over the years that I've been your liaison and highlighted that. So we've just finished a little late this year, but we finished our annual update and review of that document. It should actually be posted within the next week or so. And when it is, I will make sure to get it to your executive officer, White, and so she can distribute it accordingly to you all. But in that is many, many different actions. There's, I think, over 65 different priority actions. And of those, we double priority or make high priority some of those as well. And just as a sample, some of the highest priority actions we're looking at this year range from stormwater, looking at development of an urban stormwater capture policy so that statewide there's uniform guidance and criteria as to where capture and use of stormwater makes sense from a water quality and water supply perspective. So there should be work happening in that space. We're looking at advancing drinking water protections for PFAS in response to the EPA rulemaking from 2024, from last year, and moving forward with developing a California-based maximum contaminant level. So there will be, that's a high priority. There will be action on that this year. It's a long process, but the wheels are in motion to move that forward. And we have a whole lot going on in our watershed, the Bay Delta watershed, right now when it comes to major water right proceedings. Having our administrative hearings office just concluded the site's reservoir hearing process, and so next steps are underway there. They just started the Delta Conveyance Project hearing process last week. That hearing will go on for some time to be determined how long that may take. With the State Water Board, we're, of course, as I've mentioned before, going through an extensive and very lengthy process to update the Bay Delta Water Quality Control Plan. Still anticipating that update, which a draft was released last year, and the staff report and other documents have been released in prior years. We've been going through an extensive stakeholder engagement process, working group meetings on different specific topics on that document. Has very, very large implications for how water is managed in our state. And so that hopefully that plan will be updated and adopted at some point this year and really set the stage for the future means in which we're managing water quality flows and other aspects to both balance municipal and public uses, agricultural uses of water, and also provide improved protections for fish and wildlife resources, which is really the balance that we're trying to strike with that plan. So it's a big lift this year. We have it's a ton that we have going on, and there's a whole bunch more. I think probably 60 other actions, which I'm not going to summarize for you today. But I do hopefully look forward to seeing you all at the Water Quality Coordinating Committee meeting here in May first and second. And I know the either in person or virtually, I will be there in person. So hope anyone who can make it, I hope to see you there. I look forward to that. And I know the agenda is not out yet for that. It should be out in the near future. But one of the items that we'll hopefully see on there is a discussion about harmful algal blooms as it relates to nutrients and other issues. And I know that's an important issue to your board, as it is to many boards in the state. So wanted to lift that up for you as a little bit of a teaser for what we, some of the discussions that we might have at WQCC. That's all I have for you today. And as always, happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Sean. And we look forward to seeing you as well in Sacramento. That's coming up quite soon. Are there any questions for Sean? If not, let's go. Sean, we'll turn here in the room to our board member reports. I'll start with board member Ransom.
Nothing to report.
Board member Beelin.
None.
Board member Batty.
I've just a couple quick things. I wanted to just do a quick thank you to BCDC and to SFEI. And they have been very present in my email recently, and I think they're doing enormously important and helpful work. And so just I've been really impressed by the caliber of the work and the focus on communicating with the public on some of the key issues. So just a shout out to both of them to say thank you. I continue to share this with everyone I know everywhere about participating in democracy, which includes participating in the public forums at our meetings and other public entities' meetings. It is an important time to be speaking up and speaking out. And I know Mr. Ellsworth's issues are being well addressed, but I do appreciate him coming to speak to us. And I continue to encourage anyone who has an issue to come speak to this board or other commissions or boards in the public forum that's available. Thanks.
Thank you. Well said. Board Member Gunther.
I wanted to note that BCDC just released a draft report on ways that we can stimulate beneficial reuse of dredge material and other sediments. And I know it's related to some of what we're going to hear today, but it's a very exciting development because it was done in a collaborative, evidence-based way, which is something that's kind of going out of style in the United States, you know, and I'm glad to know that we're going to fight that tooth and nail around here. There's about 80 or 90 steps to take to enhance beneficial reuse. Not all of them are by BCDC at all, but it was done by putting heads together, including, I know, water board staff. I just thought that it's important to recognize that, you know, when we walk around the edge of the bay these days, it's completely different than it otherwise would have been because of BCDC being in place for 50 years doing things. I don't know about you guys, but when I have visitors from other coastal locations, they're astonished by how easy it is to get to the shore and by how much the shore is public. And in that kind of change, that we're about to do the same thing over the next 40 years, I hope. And we're going to take the edge of the bay, turning it into a living edge in many places where it'll be much more resilient in the second half of the century to the conditions that we know are coming. So it's a very, very important step, something that could easily kind of go under the radar. And maybe it's good that it's kind of like sort of under the radar now, but I think that we're taking a very, very important step to evolving the edge of the bay into a real living edge that will be more resilient to sea level rise in the future. So it's a very exciting time, and I'm really looking forward to today's presentation because I know it's related to that.
Thank you. Board Member Kissinger.
Nothing from me.
Very well. I'm appreciative of our board's attendance, and we had to do a little late scrambling with the agenda, and I'm going to turn now to our executive officer for her report, and I think there are a couple of really interesting things worth commenting on in your report.
Great, thank you. Yes. So though he couldn't join us today in person, I do want to highlight a retirement of a very valuable member of our team who is participating remotely today. As you saw in the executive officer's report, Cleet Carlton will retire at the end of this week after serving the public and the water board for over 20 years as an engineer and geologist for our site cleanup, landfill, and enforcement programs. There are a couple cases Cleet was engaged in that should be easy to recall from the caseload that we've shared with the board. Cleet was instrumental in documenting and compiling all the needed details for the enforcement case addressing the wetlands fills at the Dillons property in Solano County. Thanks to the comprehensive detail, the courts approved a settlement to restore the tidal wetlands and imposed a $1.7 million in penalties. Thanks to Cleet, I would just want to say that he was key to that project. In addition, Cleet managed the case and cleanup work at the former Prosperity Cleaner site in Marinward. As a diligent case manager and a thorough investigator with a passion of the Water Board's mission, Cleet also co-authored assessment tools and guidance documents, as well as participating in many initiatives to support groundwater protection. Cleet leaves a lasting legacy for those who followed in his path, and we are very grateful for his dedication and his 20 years of public service. Thank you, Cleet. I know you're listening. And then next, you all have at your spot a copy of the Pulse of the Bay 2024. And we will provide a copy to you, Bill, and Donald, who's absent today, will provide a copy to him, too. But just for the members of the public who are listening, the Pulse of the Bay is a yearly report from the San Francisco Estuary Institute that summarizes the most important information on San Francisco Bay water quality. The purpose of the Pulse is to make the most important information on bay water quality accessible to water quality managers, decision makers, scientists, and the public. The theme of the 2024 Pulse of the Bay is Contaminants of Emerging Concern. The 2013 edition of the Pulse was the first to focus on contaminants of emerging concern, also known as CECs, with the goal of providing an overview of the past regional monitoring program work, future plans, and a guide to the many chemicals being studied. The Regional Monitoring Program for Water Quality in San Francisco Bay, known as the RMP, was created by the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board in 1993 to ensure water quality management decisions and investments are guided by sound science. The Regional Monitoring Program is a collaborative effort of regulators, dischargers, industry representatives, non-governmental organizations, and scientists. The RMP has been a leader in taking on the challenge of evaluating the threats of this array of chemicals known as contaminants of emerging concern, which are defined as chemicals that are unregulated or underregulated, not commonly monitored in the environment, and have the potential to enter the environment and harm ecological or human health. A lot has happened with the Regional Monitoring Program Contaminants of Emerging Concern work since 2013, and the Regional Board has been actively engaged each year. With increased funding, successful collaborations, and advances in understanding, we have all been able to achieve successful and far-reaching impacts. Given the wealth of information generated by the Regional Monitoring Program since 2013 and the 2024 completion of a major update of the Regional Monitoring Program CEC strategy, it's once again an opportune time to summarize the state of the estuary San Francisco Bay contaminants of emerging concern science and management in this 2024 edition published by the San Francisco Estuary Institute. Enjoy the read and let me know if you have any questions. Thank you. And that concludes my report.
Thank you. Eileen, I wanted to call out a couple of things that I think are worth mentioning. One, the order requiring PFAS investigations at 12 closed landfills. Just wanted to commend the team of managers and staff for that work, which is so very pertinent and relates to the statewide effort with regard to the family of PFAS compounds. And also, I think we should mention that we are having to pause our work with regard to some of the Department of Defense sites. And if you could just briefly mention that.
Yeah, certainly. So due to funding issues that both not only the Regional Water Quality Control Board, but the Department of Toxic Substances, DTSE, the other state agencies are funding, are stopping. There's been a stop work order issued by the State Water Board for our DOD sites, and it went into effect at the end of March, and it'll be in effect through the end of June, and then we'll be able to resume in March. And we've told them that the documents are still coming in, that we need an extension because staff can't work on them at this time. And this is really a result of not getting in the initial funding that we requested, but it's something we're working with State Board on. So I want to rest assure you, although we can't work on the DOD sites right now, especially Hunter's Point that, you know, we briefed you on last year, was in the executive officer's report, we will begin working on them again come July 1st. And the good news is we have plenty of other work for our staff to work on with the site cleanup program, with PFAS. So there's other work, but they just can't charge the DOD site work right now, and therefore they can't work on it. So that's an update. Yes.
I just had a quick question, and I wanted to clarify. Is it a state funding issue, or is it a federal funding issue?
It's a federal funding issue, but it's also the states involved because we needed to ask for more money, and we didn't. Yeah. So, but it's ultimately the feds haven't provided, but we also need to ask for more. There was a lot of work required last year as part of the Hunter's Point fifth five-year review, and that was a massive document, so required substantial staff time. But the good news is the Navy understands we've got this stop work order, and that we will continue because we want the community to know, and we won't be able to, you know, go to meetings now with the community, that we will resume reviewing all their documents starting July 1st.
Anything further?
I had a couple questions.
Go ahead, Bill. Bill, please, go ahead.
No, thank you very much. So I guess I'm a little curious. Is it the case that the stop work order was issued because we will have a shortfall in our budget if state and regional water quality control board people work on the DOD projects while it's not being paid for? I mean, we're not letting people go that are on staff. Is it the case that they will then just go to some other case where there's funding available, and that's how we continue to make our budget? And I guess related to that, why can't we just run up a tab with DOD and tell them, okay, well, you were 40% short in the budget required. We're just going to add that to next year's budget. Why is it that we have to stop working on it?
Right. It's because of these complex agreements that the State Water Board and DTSC has with the federal agencies. And so when there, so to answer your question, there's an amount of money we request each year to do the work, and then then we bill for that. And because State Board's been behind in the funding because there's an agreement that needs to be finalized between State Board and the federal agencies that we have not billed, so they couldn't even give us more money if we were to ask for it at this time. So there's a number of complexities involved in it. But in short, we can't continue. State Board's very clear. Once we hit the budget numbers, we cannot continue to do that per the agreements we have with the Navy, and therefore we have to stop the work on the Navy sites. Fortunately, we have other State Board projects that are State Board funded we can have them work on, and then they can resume starting the new fiscal year. Our hope is that working with State Board and DTSE, they will request additional funds next year so we don't run into this problem again.
Any reason to believe in this administration we can expect that?
I'm not sure what to expect with this administration, I guess. We need at the State Board to be requesting more money in order for staff to be able to, I think, do all the work. We had projected needing more than we got. And so that was kind of part of the complexity of it. But the good news is the DOD staff are being redirected to work on site cleanup and underground storage program work. So there's other great work they're doing, but there's a pause in the DOD work until July 1st.
When we're paused in doing the DOD work, is DOD paused in doing the work that they're undertaking on these sites?
No, they're continuing to proceed. It's the state agencies, and it's back to our agreement. So the Department of Toxic Substances also is paused. We work very closely with them on these DOD sites, such as Hunter's Point.
Is there any risk during this pause that work is not going to be done or not done up to standard?
So there was concern. So we did ask them, because we're primarily our job is reviewing reports and decisions and how they want to proceed. And we did ask them that they were giving us reports that they wanted, you know, turned around within 30 days. And we asked for an extension that we said we want to have until the end of July, knowing that we're in the stop work order.
Okay, well, I'll take it up with you. It's a very dissatisfying situation that DOD can unilaterally, and I guess it's because of an appropriation from Congress or lack thereof, or is it just they made a decision to underfund what was necessary to do the work? It's a very dissatisfying situation, particularly if it's the latter circumstance.
Bill, it's Alexis. I think that there's more to it in terms of how we charge against certain things. And so my suggestion is that you and Eileen could exchange emails or have a quick chat, and we can get further into just the nature of this ability to charge against certain sites.
Yeah, I'd be happy, Bill, to set up some time to talk with you about it. There's a lot to it, and but the good news is we're going to continue starting July 1st to review everything they submit, and staff are going to be very busy on their other programs. But it is a disadvantage to Hunter's Point and so forth that's been waiting for 25 years of cleanup. But I will follow up with you separately, Bill.
I'd like to know as well. I'm sure I'm not alone. So, I think a deeper knowledge for all of us to understand both what's happening and why and the implications would be great.
Great.
Bill, do you have anything further?
Oh, that's it.
All right. Thank you. Board Member Gunther.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you as we go forward here, given the kind of things that are going on in Washington, for you to update us if there are, is the president could sign an executive order tomorrow that says 3 + 2 = 6. This kind of thing that we're going to have to defend our way of doing things. We're going to have to, I guess, at some points rely on state statutes instead of federal statutes, given some of the proposals at EPA. So will you be regularly informing us when, like, we're activating the emergency circuits or whatever to keep our work underway?
Yes, and that's why I wanted to include in the executive officer's report about our work on DOD sites. But I do want to clarify, without going into too much detail, that state board needs to take a resolution to their board if they want more money, and that never happened. So it's not all on DOD. There's more behind the scenes to share with you. So, but I will definitely keep you apprised of any changes. And I do want to say we continue to work very closely with our partners at EPA and other federal agencies, and they continue to do the great work that, you know, they've been chartered to do.
I'll close this out with a couple of things related to Board Member Gunther's comment. I wanted to thank SFEI for the Pulse of the Bay and the ongoing investment that underpins so much of our work. I know that in the report, the RMP, quote, is preparing to double its annual budget from $4 million to $8 million in the next 2 years. That is very closely tied to funding from US EPA. And if there should be, if any of that should be in jeopardy, we would really welcome hearing from you and SFEI on this point, because it's so critical to all the work that's being done around the Bay and in the Bay.
And definitely, I plan to keep you apprised if there's any impacts, and we've been fortunate to date that we have not had any impacts with the work we're doing.
Super. Well then, shall we continue on? Shall we now move to, there's nothing further you have on your executive officer report?
No, nothing else.
And then on behalf of the board, we thank Cleet for his 20 years of service. Let's move to item 5, the Shoreline Climate Change Resilience Planning.
Great. So the San Francisco Bay Water Board continues to work very closely with the San Francisco Estuary Institute in planning for shoreline climate change resilience. Christina Toms, Water Resource Control Engineer in the Planning Division, is going to present a status update on the Climate Change and Shoreline Adaptation Basin Plan Amendment, including community outreach and engagement efforts. Then she's going to provide an update on the Regional Board's actions to support collaborative, science-based approaches to shoreline climate change resilience planning. Then, Katie McKnight, Senior Design Manager and Environmental Scientist at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, will present the Baylands Resilience Framework, a data-driven tool to inform the planning, design, and permitting of shoreline and Bayland climate resilience projects. With that, I'll turn it over to Christina first.
There we go. All right. Good morning, everyone. I'm Christina Toms. As Eileen said, I'm an engineer in the Planning Division, and I'm excited to provide an update on the Regional Board's actions to support collaborative, science-based approaches to shoreline climate change resilience planning. Next slide, please. In today's presentation, I'll provide a brief status update on our Climate Change and Shoreline Adaptation Basin Plan Amendment, introduce a new planning tool in the Adaptation Atlas Toolbox, and illustrate how this toolbox is being used by planners and communities throughout the region. Next slide. We're grateful to report that the Climate Change and Shoreline Adaptation Basin Plan Amendment was unanimously adopted by the State Board in December. We're currently assembling the amendment's administrative record for the Office of Administrative Law, or OAL, and anticipate approval of the amendment by OAL by the end of the year. Next slide, please. We continue to engage with local planners and communities about the Basin Plan Amendment and promote the use of science-driven, phased, cross-jurisdictional, nature-based shoreline adaptation approaches. We discussed these approaches with Bay Area Flood Protection Agency Association members in December, and in January, I gave a related talk for the City of Sunnyvale's Sustainability Speaker Series. In the future, we anticipate expanded outreach to and engagement with shoreline communities such as West Oakland, Alameda, and the San Rafael Canal District to help residents understand how the information in the Basin Plan Amendment can support local adaptation planning efforts. Next slide, please. In 2019, the Regional Board funded the San Francisco Estuary Institute to develop the San Francisco Bay Shoreline Adaptation Atlas, which was the first report to analyze where and how different nature-based adaptation approaches can be deployed along the region's shorelines. Since then, the Regional Board and its partners have funded SFEI to produce a series of related reports that focus on distinct elements of shoreline adaptation, such as wildlife support, creek to bayland reconnection, marsh and beach erosion, wastewater treatment, and sediment management. Collectively, we consider these resources to be part of the broader Adaptation Atlas toolbox. We recently funded SFEI to help us define a 5-year roadmap for the Atlas toolbox that describes strategies to encourage its use by Bay Area planners and communities, share its resources with broader audiences, and update its technical analyses by filling key data gaps. Next slide, please. One of the newer tools in the Adaptation Atlas Toolbox is the Baylands Resilience Framework, which describes how landscape conditions and processes such as elevation, sediment supply, and hydrology drive future outcomes. The framework highlights where interventions may be necessary to support the long-term health and resilience of the region's baylands and shorelines. After my presentation, Katie McKnight from SFEI will present additional information about this powerful new tool. Next slide, please. Next, I'll describe examples of how the Adaptation Atlas Toolbox is being used by planners and communities in the region. Next slide, please. The toolbox, and specifically the Baylands Resilience Framework, is being used by the Regional Board and other regional dredging partners to develop the Regional Dredged Material Management Plan, or RDMMP. The RDMMP is a long-range plan for the operation and maintenance of dredge navigation channels in the bay, and the management and placement of sediment dredged from those channels. A particular focus of this RDMMP is how partners can increase the beneficial reuse of dredge material for wetland restoration and reduce the costs associated with dredging and beneficial reuse. The Balanced Resilience Framework quantifies various factors that drive the opportunities and constraints for beneficial reuse, as well as strategies for sediment placement and related information needs. Next slide, please. The toolbox is helping the regional board and its partners identify where nature-based solutions can help avoid or minimize the impacts of projects within or near baylands and shorelines. For example, we're working with Caltrans, the Metropolitan Transportation Commission, and a broad range of local partners to integrate enhancement of existing tidal wetlands into plans to improve Highway 37 between Sears Point and Mare Island. The enhanced wetlands will help protect the highway from the impacts of waves and severe storms, and buy time for Caltrans and its partners to develop plans to elevate the highway on a causeway above the reach of rising sea levels. Next slide, please. The toolbox is helping planners identify where reconnecting creeks and flood control channels to baylands can help reduce flood risks and improve sediment delivery to restoring wetland habitats. The diagram here illustrates the proposed reconnection of Calabasas and San Tomas Aquino creeks with Pond A8, part of the South Bay Salt Pond Restoration Project. By working with nature, these projects can accelerate wetland recovery while reducing the need for flood control districts to spend their limited funds on expensive sediment removal efforts. Next slide, please. The toolbox is also helping planners identify where nature-based solutions such as treatment wetlands and subsurface seepage or horizontal levees can reduce nutrient pollution in the estuary while helping to protect low-lying communities from rising sea levels and more extreme storms. For example, in this conceptual illustration of options in the Novato Baylands, the different colors represent different potential configurations of a horizontal levee, shown in blue and purple, and a freshwater treatment wetland, shown in pink. Next slide, please. As we've discussed previously, the Adaptation Atlas Toolbox classifies the entire Bay shoreline into 30 operational landscape units that cross traditional political boundaries, but adhere to those of natural shoreline processes such as tides, waves, and sediment movement. This cross-jurisdictional framework helps communities plan adaptation projects that minimize impacts along their own shorelines and elsewhere throughout the Bay. We're excited to report that the resources in the Adaptation Atlas Toolbox are currently being used by over half of the region's 30 OLUs. Planners in these OLUs are using the toolbox to help identify community priorities, define phased adaptation pathways, and develop conceptual designs for adaptation projects. Next slide, please. The use of the Adaptation Atlas Toolbox in so many OLUs is especially significant given state legislation that requires and funds communities to develop sea level rise adaptation plans. San Francisco Bay is unique in that it's the only geography in California where multiple jurisdictions can work together to submit sub-regional adaptation plans. In San Francisco Bay, the guidelines for state-approved adaptation plans are defined in the San Francisco Bay Conservation and Development Commission's Regional Shoreline Adaptation Plan, or RSAP. The RSAP describes OLUs as one way to define planning areas for sub-regional adaptation plans. It also requires plans to assess the suitability of nature-based solutions and encourages them to incorporate habitat connectivity, sediment management, and watershed approaches into shoreline planning and projects. The RSAP makes frequent reference to the Adaptation Atlas Toolbox as a key resource for communities developing adaptation plans. Next slide, please. In conclusion, the Regional Board is engaging with local planners and communities on climate adaptation directly and by supporting development of the Adaptation Atlas Toolbox. That toolbox includes a broad suite of resources that help inform how and where different nature-based solutions are most effective. These resources are being used by planners and communities across the Bay Area and are informing the development of sea level rise adaptation plans consistent with BCDC's Regional Shoreline Adaptation Plan. Now, I'll hand it off to Katie McKnight of SFEI, who will tell us more about the latest tool in this toolbox, the Baylands Resilience Framework.
All right, thank you, Christina. My name is Katie McKnight. I'm a senior design manager and environmental scientist at the San Francisco Estuary Institute, and I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having me. Next slide. So today I'm going to tell you, next slide, a little bit about why nature-based solutions are needed, which dovetails with Christina's presentation. Next slide. And then I'll dive into what's in this toolkit on focused on nature-based solutions. Next slide. So what's in the toolkit? Next slide. The latest updates, including the Baylands Resilience Framework, and how the toolkit can be used. Next slide. So we know that sea level rise is happening in San Francisco Bay, and with it will require really big changes to adapt our shoreline. And one question I think that's very present in all of our minds is how do we not leave our entire region with a concrete seawall and cuts us off from these habitats that we know and care about, our tidal marshes and mudflats and so forth. Next slide. So what can we do about it? Well, you know, there are several approaches we could take. We can look towards gray measures, things that lack biological materials like seawalls and levees. On the other end of the spectrum, we can look at natural and nature-based approaches like tidal marshes and beaches. And then, of course, there are hybrid measures, things in between. We can pair a tidal marsh with a levee and create an ecotone slope or a living levee, for example. There are also soft measures, such as policy and regulatory approaches, as well as financial measures. And in order to adapt our region, we're going to need pieces from all of these approaches to really get towards comprehensive sea level rise adaptation. Next slide. And one more. Thanks. Please bear with me with the animations. And so at SFEI, we really focus on natural and nature-based as well as hybrid solutions for a few reasons. So first, there's less guidance on these approaches at the regional scale than their gray counterparts. When we started this work 10 plus years ago, really diving into this, there were loads of manuals on riprap, but not so much on oysters or eelgrass. So that's really where we come in to help translate some of that data and make it accessible. In addition, we know that natural and nature-based measures are much more resilient and can adapt to big shocks to the system. And so they tend to be more cost-effective over time than their gray counterparts. And we also know that they provide multiple benefits to people and wildlife. Next slide. So enter our nature-based toolkit. We have two foundational documents that make up our toolkit, and we recently went live with a new website to kind of present this and give context around it to make these tools more accessible. You can scan this QR code if you want to visit the site. And it really comes down to these two foundational documents. The one on the left you're probably familiar with, the San Francisco Bay Shoreline Adaptation Atlas. We came out with this in 2019. And since then, we've been refining and bringing updates and additional guidance to expand on the concepts that we initially talked about in 2019. And then the latest tool that Christina mentioned is the Baylands Resilience Framework. We're really excited about this. It goes deep into metrics of ecosystem services, and we came out with it last year, but we have some new tools and data that's hot off the press just last week, for example. Next slide. So what's in the toolkit? Well, I've boiled it down to three main points that I want to tell you about today. The Adaptation Atlas does two things. It allows us to think about how to plan for sea level rise using nature's boundaries, the OLUs that Christina mentioned, and it also helps us understand where are nature-based solutions suitable along the shoreline. But where it leaves off is understanding where they're needed and why, and that's really where the Baylands Resilience Framework comes in and is a complement to this work. Next slide. So I'm going to walk through all three of these components, starting with using nature's boundaries to think about sea level rise planning. Next slide. So we know that sea level rise will not stop at our city boundaries. Our traditional jurisdictions are very arbitrary. Some even split our rivers down the center line, you know, looking at the two banks separately. That doesn't make any sense when it comes to sea level rise and future flooding and planning for that. Next slide. So we think what makes more sense is a science-based framework that looks at natural planning units where the landscape shares certain physical characteristics that would really benefit from being managed holistically. And we're calling these operational landscape units, or OLUs for short, but the shorthand and more understandable term is simply nature's boundaries. And we've delineated 30 OLUs in the Bay Area, which are shown on this map. They're defined by physical attributes like geomorphic processes, bathymetry, sea level rise, things that will really help us understand how future flooding will play out. And they expand all the way from the high ridgeline in the watershed down into the subtidal areas in our bay. And the important thing about why these boundaries matter is because we know that if we do one project in part of the shoreline, it could affect another part of the shoreline that it's inherently connected with. And so these units can really help us coordinate and come up with more comprehensive visioning and an understanding of how we can work together to not just have piecemeal approaches, but a whole holistic solution. Next slide. The second thing that adaptation does is it helps us understand and map suitability of nature-based solutions. Next slide. So nature-based solutions are not a one-size-fits-all, and that's why they have been slower to take off than, say, these riprap shorelines that are much easier to kind of design and plan for. Depending on the nature-based solution, there's a whole different set of criteria that we need to think about. And what's possible in one place may not be possible in another due to the physical setting and land use patterns. So it's really important to understand what could go where. So take these two photos in the slide. On the right-hand side, this is wildcat marsh, very low topography, wide marsh, gentle wave environment. On the left-hand side, around the same area or across the shoreline on Miller Knox Regional Shoreline, these are both in Richmond. It's a deep water environment. So we have a hill area that transitions to deeper water. There's riprap, which is more indicative of higher wave energy. You probably don't want to put a marsh on that left photo. Next slide. And the reason these nature-based solutions are not a one-size-fits-all is because we have these large physical processes happening at the bay scale that really shape our shoreline. And these physical processes are not anything we can tame. We have to work with them. We have to understand them. Over 40% of the precipitation that falls in California drains to the San Francisco Bay. That's coming from the Sierras, the Delta, and it's meeting up with the processes that are coming through the Golden Gate from the Pacific Ocean, things like our tides, our waves, our sediment, and they're mixing in the bay, and they're playing out in different ways. We have different tidal ranges in parts of the bay, different wave energy, and it's really important to understand these characteristics when planning for nature-based solutions. Next slide. So the Adaptation Atlas looks at 10 different nature-based opportunities, starting in the subtidal environments like reefs and eelgrass, to the intertidal like beaches and tidal marshes, to head of tide or towards the uplands like where we can connect creeks to baylands. Next slide. And for lack of time, I'm just going to talk through one example to give you a flavor of what's in the Adaptation Atlas. Next slide. So one thing that we can do is build more beaches in San Francisco Bay. We have a very diverse set of beaches. They're different than our outer coast beaches. When it comes to beaches in San Francisco Bay, they're estuarine beaches. The Adaptation Atlas talks about those nuances. You can see here in these photos, some beaches have sandy grain material. Others are shell hash. Others are cobble and gravel and things that are higher wave energy environments. And this photo is of a beach in Marina Bay. And what I love about this is you can just see how the beach is protecting the marsh behind it. It responds to its wave environment. Every time I go out to that beach to walk my dog, it looks different. And that's really the power of nature-based solutions. It's very dynamic. And so next slide, we mapped beaches for the whole region. And this is just a zoom in of where we mapped them for Richmond, which falls across four different OLUs. And we took into account things like where beaches were found historically, where they exist today, areas that have riprap shorelines or seawalls or places that might be able to use beaches to knock down wave energy. And we also thought about where are they not appropriate, channel openings, marinas, ports, places that we're actively taking sediment out of that we don't want to fill back in. And you can see where we mapped them along Richmond. They can happen in a lot of places potentially. Next slide. So looking at all 10 of these nature-based solutions, we put them together in an opportunity map, and we really like to talk about this as a menu of options. This is not a plan. This is more what could be possible based on that physical setting. And the important part to emphasize is that these approaches are not meant to be used in piecemeal. They're meant to work together to build up to a pathway. So thinking about pairing eelgrass and oysters with the beach and putting all three of those in front of a riprap shoreline to protect a rail line, for example. And this is also a tool that can be paired with a vulnerability assessment and used with communities and planning staff and others to talk about what their values are and what makes sense for them to think about. Next slide. And in Richmond, there are many, or in the Wildcat OLU specifically, there's many nature-based solutions because there's a lot of space there. And the Adaptation Atlas also talks about soft approaches, things like financial and policy measures that can also be paired. Because as I mentioned, we're going to need all of these approaches. Next slide. So that's what the Adaptation Atlas does. But as I mentioned before, it doesn't tell us where nature-based solutions are needed and why. And that's where the Balanced Resilience Framework comes into play. Next slide. So one thing that we often ask when we're talking about adaptation is, well, how resilient are the Balans? But what do we mean by that? We've had to start from a place of breaking that down and defining it. And what we typically mean is, as sea level rises, we want our marshes and mudflats to continue to do the services that are really important to us. So things like attenuating flooding, supporting wildlife, improving water quality, sequestering carbon, providing those recreational opportunities. Those are the things we really care about. So what we did is we defined all of these ecosystem services, and then we came up with metrics to measure them and understand them to basically have a tool to help prioritize decision making. We know that our resources are scarce. They're just going to become scarcer with sea level rise. And so we need a way to make data-driven decisions and how to prioritize different actions. We also are hoping to get more funding through a variety of sources to build out these metrics. So this is a starting place. The Balanced Resilience Framework is a start, and then we hope to add on carbon sequestration, recreational access, and water quality improvement. Next slide. And so I don't have time to delve into all three of those ecosystem services and the metrics, but this is just one example looking at one of the three categories, wildlife support, and the way that we broke them into specific elements. So we looked at the literature and we said, well, what constitutes wildlife support? Well, it's about connectivity within a complete marsh. It's about connectivity between marshes, so it can support different types of wildlife and how they move around. It's about redundancy and so forth. But then we had to go a step further and say, but how do we measure that? So on the right-hand side, these are the specific metrics that we broke each element into, and we came up with geospatial processes and methodologies to measure it. Now, it's a lot of information. We have a great report that gets into the weeds of all of these metrics, our definitions, the logic behind them, and so much detail. Next slide. So we brought that report and we actually translated it into a web map to make it really easy to access on the planning side. And if you have an internet connection and a computer, you can access this web map, which is super exciting. Now, the web map, you can actually go into it and look at a specific marsh unit or a diked area, like say a diked agricultural area that maybe you want to try to buy and acquire for restoration. You can click on it, and in one click, you can look at all of the results of all of the metrics that were quantified. So we had a workshop when this was in draft, and we were super excited about it, got in front of folks, and we were like, okay, what do you think? And the first reaction was, this is amazing, and how the heck do we use it? This is a lot of information. So enter the metric map book. This is more or less a user guide, a primer that helps boil down what the Balanced Resilience Framework metrics really get at and helps lead people to making their own conclusions by giving them some examples and then prompting them to the web map to dive deeper. Next slide. So one example spread, so in that metric map book, we have a two-page spread for every OLU. So that's a spread for all 30 OLUs. And in it, it gives some context on the left-hand side, some statistics of what the opportunities are in the context of how big the marsh areas are in that OLU relative to the sub-embayment. But on the right side, it gives us different ideas or insights that we pulled from the Balanced Resilience metric for that specific OLU. So these are just a subset of examples. You can actually click on one of the headers and it opens up the web map and brings you to that metric. So it's a tool to get people started. Now, one example of an insight in this OLU was the mudflat in front of San Pablo Creek is lower in the tidal frame than it could be. And so we suggest, you know, thinking about sediment placement there or putting in living shorelines to help accrete more sediment, things like oysters and eelgrass. Next slide. And as Christina mentioned, we have so many more resources and publications that really build on these two foundational documents, and they're available on our website, and we're trying to basically have a more of a communications campaign to let people know that these tools exist so they can use them to dive deeper on things like how do we connect our creeks to our baylands to get more sediment onto them? How do we actually operationalize these visioning workshops in, say, San Mateo County, which we did several years ago? What does that process look like? Next slide. And then I'll just end on this, how the toolkit can be used. So we think there are a lot of different uses for this work. You can use it to bring together stakeholders around a given shoreline unit. You can use it around assisting environmental review and permitting from the project applicant and the analyst side to ask the question of, well, have we thought about the range of possibilities here, specifically around nature-based solutions? One cautionary tale is just because it's not in the adaptation atlas doesn't mean it doesn't exist. So we like to try to encourage people not to think about these as black and white guides, but more as a framework. And we can use it as a jumping off point for the RSAP, for example, supporting local regional planners and communities as a jumping off point so they're not starting from zero. And they can, these tools can help guide investments in adaptation planning, think about how to prioritize scarce resources, track effectiveness of restoration, and also show the potential of doing a restoration project in one place based on those ecosystem services that we quantified. Next slide. So I'll end here, and I just want to say thank you so much for your support. You all have made this work in large part possible, and it's been super rewarding to be a part of. And I also had a long team listed here on this slide, but for some reason it's not showing up. So, you know, I just also want to recognize the many folks at SFEI have done this work. So thank you all so much and happy to take questions.
Thank you, Katie, and to your team. And Christina, if the two of you want to stand up there with Xavier, there may be board member comments and questions.
So, first of all, thank you so much for the effort you put in to animate your presentation. Eileen, I would really like us to make sure that we provide our speakers with the ability to control the slides themselves so that they don't run out of gas saying next slide please all the time. That was really wonderful, Katie. I really appreciate it. So just last week, we were presented at BCDC by the staff with metrics that they are developing to track the implementation of BayAdapt. And I think I know what's going on around here, but I'm not sure because of the number of different, I was told by the GIS guy at BCDC that they're working with SFEI. That's great. I mean, and I think I can see it, but there are enough metrics and work programs and that even I'm getting a little confused about how they're connected. And if I'm getting confused about it, then other people I know are lost in the acronyms. So it's not something we need to address now, but let's just be a little clearer about this. As I understand it, what's fundamentally important here is that there's now a legal requirement for every city and county to come up with a sub-regional plan over the next 10 years. And they're all telling us that they don't have the money to do it, which is true, I'm sure. But we're saying, well, I know that's hard, but you got to do it anyway. And what's going on here is you guys are giving them tools they can use at their desk to envision what could go on in their region and what the physical limitations are. When the RSAP was being developed, I submitted written comments about the importance of integrating OLUs into the RSAP. And I don't know that a commissioner had ever given written comments. It got very confusing about what to do with them. But the point was that this had, I made sure that the OLUs are there because that is going to be the fundamental planning tool for us. And if we respect the physics in our environment, our eventual outcomes are going to be much more durable. So I'm really excited about what I'm seeing. And I just, I would like to make sure that the, do we have more than one atlas now, or do we have just, I mean, there's, well, I think it's not something we need to go in detail now, but let's just think about the description of the tools and how we make sure that they're both someone in my chair and other people can understand what's available, how they relate to each other, how they're being supported. I have been arguing for the better part of a decade about the importance of SFEI to our work regionally, and particularly with respect to the shore. And I would very much like to see us develop, and Warner, we've talked about this, in the same way, using the RMP as an example, where we have funded the RMP regionally for decades, and it pays off virtually at every board meeting. And we are going to need a description of the shore that's an agreed upon thing that as we go forward. Even the pictures you showed, Katie, just what is a beach? I mean, there are multiple different ways that we go about this, and if we are arguing amongst ourselves about what's actually there in any given spot, we're going to really get behind the eight ball. And so I feel like that you are both providing tools, but you're also kind of providing our joint understanding of reality. And to do that, you then have to be able to update it as we go, and it's very expensive. And GIS tools are spectacular, but they take an enormous amount of elbow grease to keep functional. As someone who ran an organization where we were trying to build GIS tools, it's expensive. And then you get into this proprietary place where people have put all this money into this tool and they don't want to give it away to everyone else for free. But that's exactly where SFEI can come in and do that. So I see both I think we are on target here for doing something that's strategically so smart. And I hope I live long enough to see how smart we were to do it this way compared to what's going on in places where they're outlawing anything but linear models of sea level rise or whatever. But I also don't want to shy away from the challenge that we face to keep this effort funded and coordinated. And I'm really proud that the Water Board has been the source of a lot of this support. But as much as I love the Water Board, I don't see the Water Board as a long-term funding source for our regional efforts, that we're just one piece of it. When we were writing the MOU that was signed, I tried to stuff SFEI in there too, because I feel that the Institute is just an important regional resource, but it's going to be up to all of us to figure out how to work together to keep the Institute funded so that these kind of resources are available to the cities and counties who are going to have to be producing these regional plans over the next 10 years.
Well, thanks for the comment, Andy. And I just want to say I totally agree with you. We have so many different resources in the region. And, it's important to coordinate, and it's important to also coordinate on our communication efforts and how we're talking about them, how they fit together. And I do want to say, we do work closely with BCDC, and I know there have been a lot of conversations. I'm not always involved in those conversations, but I know there's a lot of planning and thinking about how can SFEI be part of that RCEP process to bring these tools and support BCDC leading it, of course. How can we be proactive and getting in front of different jurisdictions that maybe are less well-funded and thinking about these things less? Also, how can we be science advisors that are on call to help people and be a public resource more or less? So I'm hopeful that those things will be worked out and we can continue to coordinate and leverage these tools. I mean, we love giving our tools away for free since, it's funded by the public, and we hope that people will use them more. But one thing that we're also really aware of is doing more communication around this. And this was the first time, or not the first time, but the regional board, you all funded a communication effort that really allowed us to do strategic internal planning, have conversations with partners externally, put a roadmap together for where we went ahead, and also put together some visuals and talking points and more or less marketing tools to help talk about these things, because we have a lot out there, but people don't always know about them. So I think you just bring up a really great point that we also feel really passionate about.
I also want to thank you for, you know, really great work and great tools. So thank you for that. I wondered if you could talk a little bit about sort of the, a little bit more about how you're feeling about what's happening with federal funding and federal focus and the implications for this work and our partners at USEPA or other places. As you look out over the next few years, can you comment at all about what implications we might face?
So I'll start to tackle that by saying that we continue to have really robust relationships with our federal partners and continue to work with them really closely. You know, there are different pots of federal funding and operations that are affected in different ways right now. And so I think we're fortunate a lot of the work that we've been doing with regards to climate and climate adaptation with our federal partners, that's continuing to move forward, albeit, you know, it might look a little different moving forward, but we are maintaining those relationships and continuing to develop the tools and continuing to do outreach and collaborate with all of our partners, not just our federal ones.
Yeah, and from SFEI's side, I'll just say, you know, it's a scary time for all of us. And SFEI does get a large part of its funding, especially, and we have three teams, our Resilient Landscapes team, you know, 70% of our funding comes from the EPA. So this has been a big wake-up call for us to try to figure out other sources and diversify, which has been something we've been trying to do for a long time, but of course there's more urgency now. One thing that has felt really promising is partners like you all on the state side who really care about the work that we do and don't want to see us go away. And we've also been doing a lot of internal work thinking about Proposition 4 and how we can, help with these big questions coming down the pike at the state level and the regional level of how do we adapt. We think we can provide a lot of critical services there. But, you know, we're still trying to figure it out, and it's going to take a lot of work and coordination. But we're hopeful, and, you know, we're going to do whatever we can to stick around and keep doing this work.
Great, thank you. I guess I just want to say that I really appreciate the optimism and the gratitude, focus on gratitude, but I also encourage us to be very real about what's getting funded and not funded and where staff are no longer available that were in our, with our federal partners and what the implications really are so that we can plan appropriately and really dig into some of the other possibilities. So, yeah, I think we have to balance the optimism with reality. And, yeah, anyway, thank you.
And I just wanted to add and just want to remind everybody that last summer, seven regional and state agencies executed that memorandum of understanding where each agency is committed to working on sea level rise. And we're meeting regularly, and it includes the Association of Bay Area Governments, the Bay Area Air Quality Management District, the California Coastal Conservancy, Caltrans, the Water Board, MTC. And one of the things we've talked about is, as we all know, sea level rise is a regional problem, needs a regional solution, and needs money, and that we are going to work together, the agencies, ours, to prioritize so we're all not chasing the same money. And so that's one of the things we're working on, knowing that there may be less dollars, that we want to work, we feel like working together, we'll probably be more successful in getting funds that we can continue to fund the great work that SFEI is doing. So just want to let you know that's an ongoing effort.
If I can just add, I don't think it's too soon to start thinking about the renewal of Measure AA. So, I mean, the federal government, even if the insanity that's currently underway somehow subsides, the federal government is going to be consumed by emergency response and constructive, proactive work to build resilience, I think, is going to be funded regionally. a big piece of it in any event. So I would like us to be thinking about how we go out to the voters when we renew and we ask them for a little more than a buck a month per parcel, right? Because we're going to need way more money than we currently have, and how we do that effectively. And I think that the stories that you're beginning to tell here, Katie, will be fundamental to that effort. And to collaborate with the Restoration Authority and whoever else to build those stories ahead of time, so that when it comes time to it, we have a full-throated voicing from all the regional stakeholders. When it was passed originally, I'm a pretty political neophyte, but Sam Shuckett was very clear to me. He said, "If there's organized opposition, we lose." And so we need to be in that same frame when the renewal comes up, which is, it's not even that far away, is it? Was it?
No, I think
7, 8 years.
Yeah,
it was 2017 when it passed.
Yeah,
and it was 2017 when it passed, and that's 20 years, right?
20 years.
So, okay, well we have a little time. Okay.
Bill, anything you want to add to this conversation?
Nothing from me.
What? Thank you both. So informative and positive.
Thank you.
Julie, do we have any public commenters?
I'm sorry. Could I just add
Please
one thing?
Do.
The Warner Chabot, Executive Director of San Francisco Estuary Institute. I'm as impressed as you are by the work that these amazing people are doing. I'm the political hack generalist at the organization. But I do want to say that per Andy's point, we don't know what's going to happen with the federal government. We're waiting for the next shoe to drop, and it might drop in the next 6 months. Much of the work that we have funded to do is funded through the EPA and the San Francisco Bay Program. And we have a emergency worst-case scenario strategy in place if that were to occur. The dilemma that we have is that, we don't know when that shoe is going to drop. So we need to be looking at the state bond proposition for the state climate bond act, and we're making proposals and strategies to go forward with making proposals to them, so that we do things like on this issue that we're updating and maintaining the EcoAtlas tools, two, that we are communicating that to the 50 cities and 9 counties that comprise the Bay Area, and 3, so that we have the technical capacity to provide the community support to respond to all the calls that come in and say, could you help us do this, that takes 2, 3, 4, 6 hours that is not funded. So I am going to be asking, I will be coming back to this regional board to ask for your endorsement and letters of support for proposals that we will be making to different agencies, especially the Coastal Conservancy, to have that capacity, that sort of general capacity over the next couple of years to be able to do those 3 things, to update and maintain the work we're doing, to be able to communicate it to the city councils and the planners and the groups that are essential, and 3, to be able to provide on-call technical support to those communities. Because we know that it's being received well. We're getting more phone calls for assistance that we can't provide because there is no program right now that funds that maintenance, communication, and technical support update. And Andy, I think, kind of nailed it. And we do think that there is support even among the state agencies who also recognize and support. Lastly, I will say that with the RSAP process, BCDC themselves designated SFEI as the science consortium to serve the entire Bay Area. Key words are designated, absence the word funded. So we've been given the crown and a skateboard in order to spend our time going around doing the work, and an empty wallet. So the recognition is there, but we need to come through with a strategic plan, and we're developing that over the next couple of months. We'll be developing specific proposals to go forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Warner. And I think it's critical that our joint efforts keep track of where that technical support is being extended, so that as we may want to lean on others, that we can go back and cite the cities, counties, and possibly special districts that had benefit of that technical support to engender their support further. Thank you for a great conversation and update around this. I think it makes all of us optimistic.
Yeah, I just like Warner just referred to the San Francisco Bay program, and I think it would be valuable if maybe in the next executive officer's report or somewhere we provide a short description of what the EPA's San Francisco Bay program is and how long it took to get it to where it was a year ago, and what's at risk if that program is erased by the Trump administration.
And be happy to do that. And actually, we were planning to have Louisa from EPA come to our probably June board meeting.
That's perfect.
So that was already on the horizon.
Okay, great.
Julie, no further commenters have identified themselves?
No.
Very well. Thank you all for your participation and attendance today. The board is now going to meet in closed session on the 15th floor for item 8C of our board agenda. And after we complete that, I will return in just about an hour to close out this public session.
I think Mr. Kissinger has a statement.
Go ahead, Bill.
Yeah, thanks very much. I'm going to recuse myself from participation in the closed session because of representations of my firm on unrelated matters for the city and county of San Francisco.
Thank you, Bill. Very well. We'll be back in about an hour. Very well. This concludes the public session of the April 9th, 2025 San Francisco Bay Regional Water Quality Control Board meeting. Thank you for joining us. We appreciate your engagement. Our next meeting is scheduled for May 14th in the auditorium here. I'd like to thank our AGP team, David Fairbanks, Dakota Smith, and Andrew Marr, and we'll see you all next month.